Hello, welcome to Press TV News Analysis with me, Kavit Halfai. The Tunisian Revolution took place a month ago, giving rise to uprisings and revolutions in the Arab world. Libya has paid the highest price in martyrs, some reports indicating up to 6,000 dead. Yemen's President Ali Abdullah Saleh has instructed his army to defend the regime at any cost, while Saudi Arabia is awaiting the March 13th Day of Rage as it experienced protests on Friday, the day of Friday prayers, with its neighbor Bahrain witnessing massive protesters in Manama's Pearl Square. Almost all have one thing in common. Their people want regime change. We're going to discuss this more. Our guests for this news analysis include author and commentator Shahid Qureshi, who joins us from London, with the professor at the American University of Beirut, Hilal Khashan, who joins us from Beirut, and IGA director Ali Al-Ahmad, who joins us from Washington. Gentlemen, thank you all for joining us. I want to go to Ali Al-Ahmad first. Looking at Libya, why has Libya's revolution brought the most severe international reaction?
Because Gaddafi's regime is hated by many countries. Gaddafi has been always stirring trouble with his neighbors, almost all of his neighbors, and with Europe and the United States. So that's why he received the most criticism. And even some false reporting against him were made in the past weeks. So he is not internationally, he is not a well-liked figure. So that's why you saw the criticism. You know, if you see other countries who are friendly to the United States or Europe, they received less criticism because the kind of relationship, the type of relationship these governments have with the West. So if you are an anti-Western figure, you get more criticism.
Well, let's look at Hilal Khashan. Let me ask you this. Let's look at how the United States and its allies, at the way they're going to handle Libya in terms of how it's going to affect the other uprisings and revolutions in the making that's taking place.
Well, Libya is a very difficult country because it is tribally based and the country is very thinly populated. The distance between Tripoli and the east is far away. You know, there is at least 2,000 kilometers between the two sides of the borders between Egypt and Tunisia. The bloody confrontations have been crucial in aggravating the public opinion. I mean, this is the first time since the beginning of the turmoil in Tunisia that such a heavy toll has been exacted. And let's be clear, the West was until recently very reluctant to meddle into Libya's affairs. It's only after the determination of the revolution and the heavy coercion by the regime that the West came to a conclusion that they can no longer lend a blind eye to the events there. So I think the momentum is gathering. You know, day after day, there is increasing talk about additional measures in order to curb Gaddafi, and the U.S. is now talking about the implementation of a no-fly zone. Actually, even the Arab League has said that the Arab League may be considering the imposition of a no-fly zone in coordination with the African Union.
Okay. I'm having a little bit of a problem, Shahid Qureshi, understanding this no-fly zone. And the problem I have, perhaps you could expand on it more, is the no-fly zone in actuality does mean for the United States, along with some of its allies that have volunteered themselves, France, Canada, and Italy coming into the picture here, that it does require them to bomb some of the facilities, the air facilities, doesn't it? So how is that, what are the repercussions if something like that does occur, a disapproval of a no-fly zone?
Well, I think it's a very interesting state of affairs that the U.S. is too quick to jump to the military action against a country who is not invited, unlike the Iraqis who invited the United States to come and intervene. 6,000 that as reported in Libya, is one too many. But we have a similar kind of situation where about, I'll just do a comparison very quickly, about 95,000 people have been killed in the Indian occupied Kashmir. There were 700,000 in Indian army occupation. And there was no, and the UN resolution is there. So US has never said anything about the sanctions or having a no-fly zone in Kashmir, which is a, or even on Gaza, where the Israeli jets are killing innocent civilians, men, women, and children. Libyans are a case where Mr. Gaddafi should understand that it is time for him to go. And it is time, the more he delays, the more the problem will be. It is up to his advisors to tell him that if he wants to keep his country intact, unlike the foolishness of Saddam Hussein, the way he got his country is destroyed by his own actions. I think Mr. Gaddafi should be advised to, because he has lost his money already, which is frozen in U.S. and Western banks. So right. the only beneficiaries you will see are the bankers right. who got all the monies from these dictators in the Western banks, and the countries are still poor as they were before.
Right, and you mentioned dictators. We're going to get to that point in a second. But Ali Al-Ahmad, let's look at Saudi Arabia. You have a combination there of the importance of it being combustible. That's an aging regime, and also with the extreme political repressiveness. What do you think the outcome of developments there will be, and is it moving ever so closely to that regime change, which is what people have not yet altogether come out and said, but are calling regime reform in what we saw in protest there today?
Well, you are absolutely right. I think there is still some barrier to break, and we might see that barrier broken next week on the 11th of March, the big day for protest. But we saw protest yesterday, today, and last week in the East. Today we saw a small protest in Riyadh itself calling for the end of the monarchy. So next week, if the protesters are able to break that fear and that psychological wall, you will see a huge rallies calling for the for an end of the monarchy. The popular sentiment is that this government, this aging, corrupt, and has caused the country alarmed in terms of high unemployment. 80% of the people are not owners of their homes. The corruption in the family is so massive that they have expropriated the majority of the land of the country to their own. And so, and the people have no right to say anything or to even to write on the internet their feelings. So you have really all the elements to for that explosive mix, but without people breaking the barrier of fear, it will not happen. So next week is going to be a test for the country.
You think, if they can, are you surprised that they haven't broken that. Down harder the regime on what is happening? Because you mentioned the internet, people used to sign under code names, but now they're actually signing their own names. And of course, some are calling these revolutions Facebook revolutions, but it shows that people have, in some sense, broken that barrier of fear. But are you surprised a little bit that they haven't broken down harder just recently with the protests and some of the moves that Saudis have taken inside their kingdom?
Well, I think it is a bit early to decide that. I think next week we will see if this is breaking the wall. I see something gathering, you know, it's like a gathering storm. But are we going to see the storm itself? Maybe next week we'll know, really. It's very hard to say, but all the elements are there.
Okay, let's look at Bahrain, Saudi Arabia's neighbor. It's right now in a finite standstill for the short term in terms of some of the demands of the oppositions to be met and the opposition themselves uniting in one voice. But there have been accusations of outside influence that are playing the sectarian card. Hilal Kashan, if you can tell us, is that the case about this outside influence, and who is to gain from that?
Well, I mean, to talk about the outside influence in fomenting the disturbances is Bahrain is a cheap propaganda ploy in order to arrest the awakening of the people. There are real issues. There are fundamental causes. There is a need for reform, and the authorities have no chance of avoiding it. The problem is not external intervention in Bahrain. The real problem, in my view, is the complete inability of the regime to engage in meaningful reform. Instead of genuine reform, the regime is stalling and try to buy time by calling for opening dialogue. So I think issues have to be faced, and the regime in Bahrain and elsewhere need to come out of the box and begin to realize that the world around them is changing and that the trend for change is unmistakable and unstoppable. To talk about outside intervention, if it is true, attest to the fact that the regime has been lacking and wanting and inattentive to the needs of the population.
And looking at Yemen, it's a very interesting combination of statements that has come out from President Saleh. One, he has instructed his army to defend the regime at any cost, and for Saleh to have blamed the United States to be the overseer of Israel in terms of the way that they're exercising negative influence in that country. But the fact that he's ordered his army to defend the regime at any cost, I mean, can this defiance in some ways be compared to Libya's Muammar Gaddafi of perhaps what's going to be coming? Shahid al-Qureshi, my question to you.
Well, I think all the rulers in the Arab world are the same kind of rulers. They're sitting for years and without any kind of reform or change or even sharing the wealth. These areas are very wealthy areas, but the wealth wasn't trickling down to the people on the masses. Instead, they were depositing that wealth in the Western banks or the US banks. And I must share with you that over 3 years ago, I was talking to an Arab journalist, and I said the Western and the US strategists are worried about the money you have deposited. They have already kind of took control your oil wealth, but they are worried the money deposited, and they are thinking, well, how are you going to use the money? And the freezing of the assets of dictators, who are the former friends of the regimes, is quite extraordinary. It is a message to all the other dictators that you keep your wealth in your country, so at least you are able to use it. I have seen that all the dictators, including the Shah of Iran and the others, they were not able to use the wealth they've deposited in the Western or the US banks. In the end, the people who benefited were the bankers. Similarly, the cases in Pakistan, I mean, the Zardari regime, the Nawaz Sharif, they all deposited their or invested billions of dollars when the country is starving in Western or the U.S. banks, and the country is going to IMF for any kind of bailout plans. So there is a message for these rulers or dictators, basically, that at least you share the wealth with the people. So people will give you a space where you can be at least buried. I mean, unfortunately, I mean, as you're aware, the Shah of Iran didn't find a space to be buried in his own country. He was buried in Egypt. And where was his wealth? And I think that is keeping the dictators in the region sleepless. And I think the sooner they realize, the better.
Well, let's look at and extend your sentiment there with Ali al-Ahmad. In terms of the U.S., I mean, it's well known that they were backing what's been called dictatorships for so long, and then now they have come out and they're calling for the reforms, basically democracy from the ground up in these Arab countries, whose countries are calling actually for greater demands, such as, well, the fall of the regimes. How do you size up the U.S. conduct as these revolutions and uprisings are taking place? I mean, is Washington in a mode of damage control at this point?
I think they are trying to continue their policy while also trying to give the impression that they are supporting democracy. Let's take, for example, Yemen. They are still funding the Yemeni regime with weapons and cash, and simultaneously are not supporting the aspiration of the Yemeni people. They have not used that word. It's a code word for we support you against your government. They have not pressured Ali Abdullah Saleh like they asked Qaddafi, for example. Obama said Qaddafi should step down. These statements were never uttered against the King of Bahrain or the Yemeni president or even Hosni Mubarak. So you see that the U.S. friends, even if they do more damage to their people than other dictators, they still do not get the American stick. They are supported. Yes, the United States would like to give that impression that they are for the people, but in reality, sometimes even they are unable to use words to support them, because the nature of the policy is to support dictators, because the American policy since the World War II has been support the dictators and not support the people, because our interests are served best with dictatorships, not democracies in the Middle East.
Well, let's take a look at the case of Egypt's revolution that has taken place, Hilal Kashan. The sudden resignation of the prime minister just a couple of days back. Interestingly, it was a week after the visits of UK's David Cameron and the two U.S. senators, John McCain and Joseph Lieberman. I mean, can it really be called a sudden resignation of the prime minister after we had those high-profile visits by U.S. Senators and the UK's prime minister?
Well, I am hesitant to connect between the sudden resignation of the prime minister and these two high-profile visits. There is no question that these foreign delegations gave their advice, but in all honesty and fairness to the Egyptian revolution, as we can see, the Egyptians are determined and they are not letting off. I mean, they are going to the Midan al-Tahrir on a daily basis, and their demonstrations are substantial. And it has become increasingly and unmistakably evident to the military establishment that is operating in the country that there is no way around the genuine and determined demands of the people. So it is not really, the resignation is not truly a function of these high-profile visits. What these visits may have done is that convinced the Egyptians and presented the matter to them in a language that they could possibly understand, that there is no turning back and that the needs and demands of the people must be fulfilled.
Okay, when you talk about, see, I get confused when there's an extension coming from the U.S. or from the U.K. or a combination of U.S. and EU countries. This extension, in terms of Egypt, they come out, we noticed with David Cameron in particular, extension to the youth, but did not bother talking to the opposition in the case of Egypt being the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, it seems like they should learn their lesson since they have not established real communication and dialogue with the opposition that existed in these countries. Ali Al-Ahmad, isn't that the case where they have failed in some respects, or else they would perhaps foresee some of these uprisings that are occurring as we're seeing?
Well, the American policymakers and their think tanks have really failed to see the this revolution coming, because for the longest time, since World War II, they have been talking to the governments, and only the governments. Let's take, for example, Bahrain. The United States Navy and United States government refused to talk to the people of Bahrain. The New York Times had an article a couple of days ago saying that the United States Navy Fifth Fleet in Bahrain refused to give children of poor Shia villages gifts. Somebody has suggested this, that, you know, to have programs to give poor children some gifts, you know, some school supplies. They said, no, we're not going to give these Shia poor kids in Bahrain school supplies, because we don't want to upset the ruling family. And the U.S. State Department banned leading democratic and human rights leaders in Bahrain from entering the United States. So while simultaneously sending arms and weapons to the monarchy in Bahrain, this is happening everywhere in Saudi Arabia, Egypt. So because that one-sided policy that the United States has in those countries, the United States was not informed or did not predict a revolution that's coming. And the ironic thing is they are still continuing that the policy that they are only talking to the governments and they're hearing from the dictators that everything is good, we are under control, we control everything. And then they are surprised when they see a revolution in Saudi Arabia or in Bahrain.
Right.
And of course, the national security in the White House is one of those areas where they are not well informed about the region.
And when you talk about that one-sided U.S. policy, we can't go without mentioning Israel. And I'd like to ask this from Shahid Qureshi. And I want to get to Israel in a second, but before that, reflect on the Arab sentiment on the ground there regarding the United States. It's at its lowest. How will that affect Israel and its position of where it's located geographically?
Well, Israel is a state which is barricaded itself. It hasn't opened up and connected with the local neighbors. They are still join the Eurovision Song Contest because they are not supposed to be in the Europe. They're not in Europe, but they still identify themselves with the Europe because they don't have friendly relationship with the neighbors, and there is no strategic thinking into that these are the people we're going to live for the rest of our lives. I mean, and these people are living there for hundreds of years. So it's for the Israeli state to think about, to review their policies, that how they're going to deal with the new Arab world, including new Egypt, new Jordan, and especially the people living inside the occupied territories. It's for them to understand if they don't do their homework now, or if they don't review the policy, or if they're waiting for the U.S. to support them in the United States UN Security Council all the time. The U.S. is a bankrupt state itself. It lost two wars in the last 10 years in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And if they're thinking of opening a new theater in Africa, especially North Africa against China or something, that will be really, really a disaster for the United States. And maybe the United States might, as some analysts says, disintegrate, and that will be the end of the genie in the Middle East as well. I mean, this is, but
okay.
Again, we are talking about
running out of time,
saving the innocent people.
I'd like to put it a final question to Hilal Kashan. Why hasn't there been a successful Arab diplomatic intervention in any of these cases, in particular Libya we could mention, but of course any one of the countries, in your opinion?
Well, the Arab countries have held scores of summits since 1964, and they never agreed on anything. I don't understand why they should be able to do so now.
Okay, well, on that note, we're going to end it. Thank you very much, Hilal Kashan, professor of American University there from Beirut. Thank you for your statements. Also, Ali Al-Ahmad from Washington, he's the IGA director, and Shahid Qureshi from London, author and a commentator. Thank you, gentlemen, all, for your views, and of course, you, the viewer. Thank you for watching. Send us your questions, newsroom@presstv.ir, from Yikava Tagway and the entire team. It's goodbye for now.